Hello, and welcome to Conversations from the World of Allergy, a podcast produced by the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. I'm your host, Dave Stukas. I'm a board-certified allergist and immunologist and serve as the social media medical editor for the Academy. Our podcast series will use different formats to interview thought leaders from the world of allergy and immunology. This podcast is not intended to provide any individual medical advice to our listeners. We do hope that our conversations provide evidence-based information. Any questions pertaining to one's own health should always be discussed with their personal physician. The Find an Allergist search engine on the Academy website is a useful tool to locate a listing of board-certified allergists in your area. Finally, use of this audio program is subject to the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Terms of Use Agreement, which you can find at www.aaai.org. Today's edition of our Conversations from the World of Allergy podcast series is targeted towards healthcare professionals and also the general public. And as you are going to find out, this is a topic that really impacts about 10% of the population. Today's guest is Dr. Allison Ramsey. Dr. Ramsey is employed in the Division of Allergy and Immunology and Rheumatology at Rochester Regional Health and is a clinical assistant professor in the Division of Allergy, Immunology, and Rheumatology at the University of Rochester Medical Center in Rochester, New York. Dr. Ramsey is the former chair of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, Immunology Adverse Reactions to Drugs, Biologicals, and Latex Committee and serves as an editorial board member for the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology in Practice. Dr. Ramsey's clinical and research interests are centered around drug allergy, which is one of the main reasons why she is a great guest for today's topic. Dr. Ramsey, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Dave. I'm really happy to be here.
Now, I think this is going to be great. And I always love hearing perspective from our wonderful experts, and you have a wonderful experience and perspective with this topic in particular. But I'd like to begin by learning more about what initially got you interested in drug allergy and why that's remained a focus of your career all these years.
Yeah, I was reflecting on that, and I think I really like that drug allergy is high yield for the patient, in that once you evaluate someone for drug allergy, you're opening up more therapeutic possibilities for their care. And I also think it's good for the healthcare system in general. So we know if someone's avoiding a drug that they may otherwise tolerate, it can be more costly for the healthcare system, or it can raise the risk of resistant organisms. So I really like that it is both beneficial on an individual level and also on from a public health perspective. And I also think it's just kind of a patient and referring provider satisfier. I think people are happy that they've gotten it taken care of, and the referring healthcare professionals are happy that they have more to choose from, assuming that everything goes well with their drug allergy evaluation, which it does in the vast majority of cases.
Yeah, and we're going to learn all about that. But do you find that even our colleagues in primary care and other specialties, do you think that they just generally have like a lot of misconceptions or confusion surrounding drug allergy?
I would say the number one misconception, and I think actually backing up a step, I think the onus is on us to educate our colleagues about what we can offer from this perspective. So having those conversations with people you interact with about other allergic conditions, I think can go a long way, because I think the most common misperception or misconception people have is that drug allergy field is a black box. And once something is entered in there, it stays there and it can't be revisited. And we as allergy immunology experts know that's not the truth, but I think we could do a better job educating other healthcare professionals and patients that, you know, this should be a plastic field. It should be revisited. It should be sort of a living document.
I love that. I love how you describe that. And yeah, that's exactly what we're gonna try to do with our conversation. That's for sure. So why don't we start with the basics? Can you just start by describing the different types of allergic reactions that can occur from medication?
Sure. So I think that the most important thing to recognize is that to our patients, everything's an allergy. Mm-hmm. And I think remembering that can help we as the experts take a more sort of accurate history and help our patients help us help them. So an adverse drug reaction is the umbrella term. And that is really anything that can go wrong with a drug outside of a intentional or unintentional overdose or abuse. So that includes anything caused by your immune system, which we as allergists tend to think of an allergy or hypersensitivity. But it also includes intolerances or expected side effects, like an opioid made you nauseous, or you felt like you got heartburn from an NSAID. So adverse drug reaction, thing to remember, is it's the umbrella term. A drug allergy, even though it's kind of used as the umbrella term, historically was for any immune-mediated drug reaction. And some people narrow it down a little further and say it's any IgE-mediated drug reaction. So I tend to think of an allergy or hypersensitivity as your immune system is in on the game. So this is an immune-mediated process, whether it's IgE or T cells or a combination of other immune inflammatory cells. And then intolerance is sort of a non-immune mediated side effect. So, you know, nausea, like I said, with opiates, or getting a headache with a certain antibiotic. And the definitions are important because it really does influence your decision making about whether or not a patient should avoid a drug for their life, or whether it's okay to introduce it at home, or whether we should try to introduce it in our office.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot to unpack there, and I think we're going to spend the next portion kind of hopefully dissecting some of this. So let's go back to that immune-mediated, or what we'll call allergic reaction. Are these all the same? So you mentioned IgE, IgG, delayed onset. Tell us how these present, how are these different in regards to how they present?
Right. So I think we've all been, we should be well-versed in the Kellen-Coombs classification system, and that still rings true today. So IgE, or a type 1 reaction, or an IgE-mediated reaction, is when you have your sort of allergy antibody recognize a drug and produce the kind of response that many are familiar with, such as hives, angioedema, bronchospasm, hypotension. These are symptoms that, if there are two or more body systems involved, is classified as anaphylaxis. Mm-hmm. So this type of reaction occurs quickly, so within minutes to hours. And I think there is also the misperception that this is the most common type of reaction or the most feared type of reaction. I think this is the one that everyone sort of falls back to when they think about a drug hypersensitivity reaction. But there are other types of reactions, as we all know. So you can have a T-cell mediated reaction, which can be anything from a contact dermatitis to a delayed morbilliform rash to the more really severe cutaneous reactions, like Stevens-Johnson syndrome or toxic epidermal necrolysis or DRESS, drug rash with eosinophilia and systemic symptoms. There's quite a spectrum of T-cell mediated reactions, and there are other immune cells in on the game. But the important thing to recall with those is that they're delayed. So they happen within days to sometimes even up to 6 weeks after an exposure to a drug. And then there are other immune-mediated reactions, like hemolytic reactions, which are known as type 2 reactions in the Kellen-Coombs classification, or type 3 reactions, which are serum sickness-like reactions, which present with joint pain, swelling, fever, and sometimes a more atypical urticarial rash. So there's a lot to kind of keep track of in the framework of drug allergy. And then there's even newer described reactions like the MGPRX2 receptor reactions, which we think mediate some hypersensitivity reactions like fluoroquinolones, for example. But it's important to kind of think within this construct because it really helps you decide whether you should think about reintroducing a drug to a patient or even how you should treat them acutely if it's right in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's say somebody does have one of those delayed onset T cell mediated reactions to an antibiotic. Does that mean next time they get the antibiotic that they're going to have an IgE mediated anaphylactic reaction? Is there sort of crossover between these different classifications of the immune system?
That's a really good question. And the answer is no. But the other thing is that for some T cell mediated reactions, you're never going to reintroduce the drug again anyway for the really severe ones. So for Stevens-Johnson or TEN or DRESS, that's going to be a lifelong avoidance of the drug. But for the milder delayed sort of morbilliform rashes, or I think as allergists, we say maculopapular rashes, but I know our dermatology colleagues don't really like that. But for those just delayed rashes where you don't have any other organ involvement, a lot of times a reintroduction will be tolerated and does not put you at increased risk for any of the other types of reactions.
Okay. Well, you mentioned this already, but what should we focus on for clinicians when they're taking a drug allergy history? What are some of the important details to ask about? And really, how does this, you know, assist diagnosis or aid reintroduction?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And I think it can't be emphasized enough that this is our expertise and this is our training. And this is what makes us as allergy immunology physicians or healthcare professionals experts in the area of drug allergy, because we know what questions to ask. And so these should include what specific drug. So if it's just penicillin and that's all the patient knows, for example, fine. But it's helpful to know if it's piperacillin, tazobactam, or if it's amoxicillin or it's ampicillin. So as specific to the type of drug as you can get. And then timing matters. So how long ago did this reaction occur? I'm going to think differently about a reaction that occurred 2 weeks ago as compared to a reaction that occurred 30 years ago. And then another timing question is, when in the course did the reaction occur? Because that gets at that classification I was talking about before. So we're going to think differently about it if they say, oh yeah, like 5 minutes after I took this medication, I got hives, versus, yeah, I took this medication 2 weeks ago and then I got sores in my mouth. So timing on both those, from both those perspectives, how long ago and then where in the course of the antibiotic, and then certainly symptoms. So I've mentioned symptoms that kind of go along with an IgE-mediated reaction, and I've mentioned the delayed morbilliform rash with a T-cell-mediated reaction. So getting patients to characterize their symptoms, especially because a lot of times we're taking this as sort of a historical event, the patient's not right in front of us experiencing the reaction as we're interviewing them. We also want to look for red flag symptoms. So those would be symptoms that make us, you know, would put the brakes on any potential reintroduction. And those would be any signs of a severe cutaneous reaction. So blistering of the mouth or any mucous membranes or sloughing or blistering of the skin. Certainly if you hear someone was hospitalized in a burn unit or something like that, that would preclude reintroduction. So really getting the patient to characterize their symptoms. I think an important asterisk here is that a lot of patients think that any rash is a hive. So trying to get that characterized to make sure it wasn't just an itchy rash, because that can really help you dial in on whether you're dealing with an immediate or a delayed reaction. I always ask if patients received urgent medical attention, because if, you know, they took something at home and felt better within a day or a few days, that certainly is more reassuring to me than if someone says they were hospitalized or received epinephrine. I ask if they recall what they took. And then I think we really need to do our due diligence, because sometimes patients will spend time gathering this history. And you know what? It turns out that they got it dispensed from the pharmacy a year ago and tolerated it. So I always think it's worth checking and asking, have you had this medicine in the interim? And they may say no, but you can go a step further and make sure that they are actually correct. Because we can't assume, you know, the vast majority of our patients aren't medically trained. We can't expect them to recall every detail that would be helpful for our evaluation. And then I also ask, you know, if there is a pressing issue for which they need the drug we're talking about. And sometimes that's obvious and sometimes it's not.
Mm-hmm. Oh, those are all great tips. So yeah, it's the details, right? It's the little tiny details, which oftentimes cannot be recalled. I had a recent example of a parent told me that, you know, their child is deathly allergic to Augmentin, which is why their pediatrician only prescribes amoxicillin, which, you know, was okay. This is very reassuring here. Let's talk about this.
Right. And then your guard is immediately down, or the patients that are avoiding it just because everyone in their family is allergic to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And just to clarify for our listeners, does, a reported family history of drug allergy, is that inherited from one person to the next? Do we need to worry about that?
Dave, it is not inherited, with the exception of some of the anti-epileptic and HIV medication, HLA types that can raise confer a higher risk. But for our run-of-the-mill patients that are coming in for antibiotic allergy delabeling, you do not need to worry about family history,
All right, excellent. And just to
which
kind
is
of
my
recap.
favorite. Oh, sorry, I
Oh
didn't
no,
mean to
please.
interrupt you.
No, why
I
that's
was
your
just gonna
fate.
say my favorite thing because we always have to document family history. You don't even have to ask about it. I always just write no relevant family history of drug allergy because it's almost always true.
Ah, there you go. I like that. But to kind of recap, because you gave us great information about what historical elements to tease out when you're taking the drug allergy history. So really, does that history then automatically help us assess risk for future administration? And if so, how?
Yeah, so I think I absolutely think it does. And again, I think this is what makes us experts in this area, because we know that our toolbox is pretty slim pickings in terms of testing here, right? For objective testing. So the history is really what's going to guide your thinking. And certainly every case is different, every patient's different. If there is an equal alternative antibiotic, then or let's just say drug, doesn't have to be an antibiotic, then maybe your job's done. But a lot of times these people end up in our office because there isn't an equal and acceptable alternative. And in those cases, I really think the timing matters, which I said before. So a more remote reaction is much easier to sort of challenge than a reaction that occurred very recently. I think the fewer the body systems involved. So, as a rule, just strictly cutaneous reactions that occur remotely are more reassuring to me than something that is more recent and involves multiple body systems. So I think those two distinguishing elements of the history are very helpful. And I also think ruling out the red flag symptoms, so the lack of red flag symptoms like blistering, mucosal membrane involvement, sloughing of the skin, anything that would indicate a severe adverse cutaneous reaction.
That's great. And for listeners who are interested in learning, more details on that, we actually had a great podcast a year ago where we had David Kahn on, who discussed the 2022 Drug Allergy Practice Parameter Update, which spends a significant portion of that document really walking through the importance of risk stratification and how that can then influence subsequent diagnosis and readministration. So we can put those links in the show notes for listeners as well. Now, what if somebody has you experience like these known sort of side effects? They're common side effects, whether it's nausea with opioids or itching or let's say GI upset when you take an antibiotic. Does that person need to avoid that medication for the rest of their life, or can we oftentimes find ways to administer that again?
Yeah, so I think often you can find ways to work with patients and the other healthcare professionals involved in their care to get them the needed medication. I think the first thing we can do here is reassurance because, again, our patients don't have the medical training that we do in the vast majority of cases. I mean, even if they're, another medical professional, they're not drug allergy experts. So I think labeling the reaction appropriately is helpful. So if you're able to say, this is not a drug allergy or hypersensitivity, this is not your immune system, this is a known side effect of this drug, that's very reassuring for people. And then beyond that, it's really a benefit risk analysis with shared decision making about whether or not it's worth trying that medication again. So if it's an antibiotic, for example, and they have limited options because they have a resistant organism, maybe we can treat them through the headache or the nausea. If they have a mild infection and there's other antibiotics on the table that will also, treat the infection, then maybe we don't have to address it then. And so I try to have that conversation proactively with people, because a lot of times we're seeing people with not just one sort of thing listed in their quote drug allergy field. So if I'm addressing one of those sort of more intolerance questions, I try to just say that, you know, in the future, if you need this drug, there's not a reason not to take it from an allergy standpoint. And we have other things we can give you to prevent the side effects that you don't want.
I like that a lot. Well, what about somebody who has like one of these type 1 IgE mediated reactions, and the history is very convincing. Yes, I had anaphylaxis to this medication, this antibiotic, you know, even years ago. Is it possible that that person can actually tolerate that drug after a period of time, or do they need to avoid it for the rest of their lives?
So I think, yeah, this is one area where we can help to change the thinking. And the best data we have with this is with penicillin. So we know that there's patients that have convincing histories of anaphylaxis to penicillin, and they've been successfully treated with it in the future. So the commonly cited figure is that 80% of people resolve their penicillin allergy in 10 years. And in general, we think of people as being lower risk as they get to the 5 year or more mark since their reaction. And as everyone, not everyone, but most listeners to this podcast know, we also have a great risk stratification tool with for penicillin in terms of with skin testing in patients that have a history convincing for anaphylaxis. For other drugs, you know, I think it really is a risk-benefit analysis using some of the reasoning that I was getting at before. If someone really needs a drug and they've had a more recent episode of anaphylaxis, we can always do desensitization, or also known as a temporary induction of drug tolerance. If the history is more remote, you know, many years ago, and the history is maybe not suggestive of anything disastrous or severe, I've definitely challenged those people to other needed drugs, you know, outside of the penicillin family.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a great segue and really the main focus of our conversation today. So let's dive right into it. Dr. Ramsey, I'm talking to you, I should say. can you set the record straight and just tell us, why is penicillin allergy so commonly reported in the general population?
I know, it's 10% of the population. Everyone likes to tell you how it's in their family. In inpatient populations, it's been reported to be even higher, like 20%. And we know that penicillin-based antibiotics are used commonly, right, for outpatient infections, like in childhood, like otitis media or sinusitis, and in adulthood as well. And the reason it comes up so much is a lot of times people are labeled in childhood. And anyone who has kids or has been around kids know that kids get a lot of viruses. And with those viruses come rashes. And coincidentally, a lot of times, these kids may also be on penicillin-based antibiotics. And so at the time, it may be really hard to figure out, is this a viral rash? Is this the drug? And so then the drug goes on their allergy list, and on they march with their penicillin allergy label. So that's a really common way that penicillin allergy ends up on, you know, listed in people's medical records. So just a viral rash that's mistaken for a drug allergy. Sometimes there's actually synergy where the alarm signal from the viral infection plus this sort of exogenous antibiotic together produces a danger signal to the immune system. So it's kind of that interplay. So those are the main reasons people end up with this label in childhood. And as we kind of talked about before, sometimes people legitimately do have a reaction, but it can change over time. Your immune system can grow out of it. So I mentioned the statistic for IgE-mediated reactions to penicillin. We know a lot of delayed reactions really just aren't reproducible. The mild delayed reactions aren't reproducible when the drug's introduced. So that's why people end up with it, but we're trying to change that by getting people and their healthcare providers to realize that their allergy field should be an in and out type of place. Something should go in and try to come out. It should not be a black box.
No, that's great. All right, so help me with some very basic math. You said 10% of the population, If I believe there's roughly 330 million Americans, let's just focus on the United States right now. So, approximately how many people in the United States are walking around thinking that they're allergic to penicillin?
Too many.
So, yeah, a lot. Like tens of millions of people. Tens of millions of people.
Millions of people do, stupid.
That is absurd. Oh my gosh, it's horrific. All right, so help us understand what led to the creation of the new American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology position statement titled Penicillin Allergy Evaluation Should Be Performed Proactively in Patients with a Penicillin Allergy Label.
So I have to say that this is not new. It's new and improved, or new and updated, let's say. The first version was 2017. And the new position statement has just been completed. And really the position is that everybody with a penicillin allergy should be considered for an evaluation to get rid of that penicillin allergy, because we have lots of opportunities for the whole reason I love drug allergy to affect people's care on an individual level and then reap the public health benefits as well. So that's the reason for the updated statement, because we know that patients who have an unverified penicillin allergy are at risk for individual adverse outcomes like decreased cure rates, increased recurrence rates, increased side effects from more costly second-line antibiotics. And the side effects can be something like C. diff-associated diarrhea or antibiotic-associated diarrhea, acute kidney injury, acute liver injury from these second-line antibiotics. And then from a public health level, we know that I'm sorry, if patients avoid penicillins when they would otherwise tolerate them, we know that if they're hospitalized, they have longer hospital stays, they have more costly hospital stays, and then the resistance patterns go up. So for example, like MRSA patterns increased. So there's lots of reasons to take care of this allergy label. And I do think it's a flip in thinking, because of course patients think that their allergy label protects them, right, from receiving something that they may have an adverse reaction to. But I think it's harder to flip that and consider the adverse effects of continuing to avoid the antibiotic. And again, I think we have lots of opportunities for education there, and the position statement gets at that.
No, I think that's great. Are you aware of the Quad AI's Penicillin Allergy Center on their website?
I sure am, and I'm glad you mentioned it. So there is a whole web page regarding penicillin allergy on the Quad AI website. I certainly can't take credit for it now, but I like to say I had a little hand in starting it when I did my Quad AI mentorship project, plug for the Quad AI mentorship program as well. But it's this web page where you can find every question, or I'm sorry, every answer for your penicillin allergy questions all in one place. So you'll find the position statement there. I maintain a list of sort of curated articles on penicillin allergy. So anyone who's listening to the podcast that thinks, hey, I'm not doing enough of this, literally, we've done your literature search for you for all the questions you may have regarding this and a lot of things I've already mentioned on the podcast. So there's that. There's some videos. We just updated, well, this was a few years ago. Dr. Allison Norton and I sort of updated penicillin allergy from the pediatric and adult side. I feel like that's probably even maybe I probably need to update those again. There's some teaching slides that are being updated. So if you want to go out in the community and educate your colleagues about penicillin allergy, there's ready-made slides there that are approved by the Quad AI. So there's a treasure trove of penicillin allergy-related information. And I should also say that on the Jackie in Practice website, the journal website, there's also a curated collection of drug allergy papers from Jackie in Practice that can be a helpful resource. There's a section on penicillin there as well.
Yeah, that's great. And we'll put links to this in the notes on the website for the podcast. And anybody, if you're interested, just search Quad AI, AAAAI, penicillin allergy. It'll take you right there. And it is a treasure trove of information. You will see Dr. Ramsey's smiling face on one of her video modules, along with Dr. Norton. There's even infographics people can share on social media channels. And like you said, like your lit review, your lit search is right there for you. So yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I appreciate that you said that this is new and improved, but it's not new. I mean, the academy and folks like yourself, you've been talking about this for years and years and years. And you mentioned why it's problematic. Just having that allergy label listed on your medical record leads to worse outcomes and more expensive care. So let's walk through some of the details about how do we evaluate. So when is it appropriate to use penicillin allergy skin tests or even blood tests to diagnose patients?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Dave. And I think that that is something that's really evolved since I started practice in 2011. That's a lot longer time ago than I would like to admit. But So we used to, you know, use penicillin skin testing for anyone that showed up with a history of penicillin allergy. And, you know, it wasn't a hot topic back then. It wasn't something you got a lot of referrals for. And I think interest and research in the field has really accelerated since that time. And I'm really pleased to say that in kids, the vast, vast majority of children do not need penicillin skin testing, which is a huge, huge child and parent and healthcare provider pleasing fact. So you mentioned the updated drug allergy practice parameters. The practice parameters recommend against doing skin testing in pediatric patients who have a cutaneous only reaction history to a penicillin based antibiotic. So that means kids that get referred to an allergy practice should be evaluated through a challenge. And there's some degree of variation on how people conduct the challenge. You know, many people do a two-step challenge just due to time-based billing. So like a tenth of the dose and then the full dose. So I think that this is a really great advancement in the field on the pediatric side, because think about all the childhood infections, like I mentioned before, ear infections. So you've got your amoxicillin is first line. You don't want that off the list. And for adults, really the recommendations have shifted so that the only time we use penicillin skin testing in adults is if they have a history suggestive of anaphylaxis, so two or more body systems involved. So for adults that have a cutaneous only reaction history 5 or more years ago, I'm pretty much exclusively doing graded challenges, as are most experts in the field. My colleague Shahzada Mustafa and I published the first randomized trial comparing direct challenges to skin testing, and in this specific population of cutaneous only reaction histories. And then I'm really pleased to say a better powered and really well done trial was just published by Anna Copescu and Jason Trubiano and Elizabeth Phillips and all of their wonderful colleagues, looking at using the PENFAST rule, which I know you and I are going to talk about, and doing a graded challenge in the patients that qualified compared to skin testing. Using the PENFAST rule, and showed the same thing. So bottom line is we are only using penicillin, or we should only be using penicillin skin testing in patients who have a history suggestive of anaphylaxis. And if it's a cutaneous only reaction history more than 5 years ago, these patients should be challenged.
I think that's very, very helpful. You know, you made me think of something that I haven't thought about in a long time. So I'm a few years ahead of you in regards to when I did my fellowship training, and there was a period of time when we had a shortage on one of the components for the penicillin allergy skin testing, and we were kind of stuck. And so this is what the mid 2000s, I believe. And then it was a detailed history, and either consider the direct oral challenge given the risk stratification, or unfortunately go to desensitization. So it's not like, you know, we always had these skin tests available. We have been able to evaluate patients in the past, and I think oftentimes they're kind of used as a crutch, unfortunately. What about the blood test? You can do a blood a specific IgE for penicillin. Is there any role for that in the evaluation of any patient?
So I've never ordered this test, and the testing characteristics are not impressive. I still think the test has found its way into Europe practice parameters, but not in the United States, and it's not something that I think is necessary at all. So I would disregard that.
Yeah, I think it speaks volumes that you don't use this as one of our leading experts in the field. And if I recall, I think, the false negative rate was ridiculously high, like 30% or something like that. So yeah, I agree. That's
may as well use a coin flip if you're going to do that, right?
Or direct challenge, perhaps.
I'm kidding.
Speaking of, when should we think about, you sort of alluded to this, so direct oral challenges for penicillin, to clarify, it sounds like you mentioned in children especially, if they have this, history of delayed onset rashes or adults with cutaneous only symptoms, what are some of the details surrounding the challenge? You mentioned this 1090, can this be done in the outpatient setting? Is it safe to do? Are we going to cause anaphylaxis? How do we know that it's safe? All that fun stuff. Tell us more.
Yeah, so I think we definitely have a really amazing literature base now with both kids and adults, honestly, in my opinion, that this is safe. And yes, this can be done in the outpatient setting and should be done in the outpatient setting. It's not something you want to sign someone up for the hospital for. So in my clinic, we do both pediatric and adult patients. Again, there's some variation, sort of expert to expert, practitioner to practitioner, based on like the nitty gritty of it. But in general, a two-step challenge is how you can proceed, where you give a tenth of the dose. In our clinic, we use 20 milligrams for peds, 40 milligrams for adults. Some people just use 20 or 25 for both. I don't think you have to be dogmatic about that. We wait 30 minutes and then do the full dose. So in pediatrics, 200, and in adults, 400. And again, this is amoxicillin. Mm-hmm. And then have patients wait another 31 minutes. So you have more than an hour for the billing side of things. Some centers have patients wait an hour and an hour. Again, that's probably more of a style point. And if you're choosing patients based on appropriate risk stratification, based on the drug allergy history that we've talked about today and that you would take from them, their risk of anaphylaxis is exceedingly low. And their risk of a reaction in kids, it's like less than 1%. In adults, it's less than 5%. And in the major trials, like the one I just mentioned, or the ones I just mentioned, all of the reactions were non-severe. There were no administrations of epinephrine. In a review on penicillin allergy, that's also a really well-done review. It's a few years old now, but it's Shenoy et al. In JAMA. There's like been one death from amoxicillin since the 1970s. Not in a challenge setting and just an antibiotic administration. So it's exceedingly safe. It can be done in the outpatient allergist office. And in fact, I think this movement towards direct challenges, the hope is that this can be adopted by non-allergy healthcare professionals that have the time and interest to do it. I think it's always hard because our primary care colleagues have so much to accomplish in a visit. But if there's a way to fit it into the workflow, I think it'd be appropriate there in the appropriate low-risk patient. And certainly this is also something that can be done on the inpatient side, and we do it at our healthcare system without transferring patients to a higher level of care.
That was a great explanation. And I always go back to, as we talked about, just in the United States alone, we're talking 30 million people that need to be delabeled. And if we're going to take proactive efforts to it, allergists, immunologists, we can't do it alone. Yes, we want to lead the charge.
There's not enough of us.
Yeah, we want to lead the charge. We want to educate, we want to raise awareness, we want to advocate, we want to help everybody else understand this. But there are excellent examples of even pharmacists getting involved. And you can do this in the outpatient
That's exactly
study.
Right.
Yeah, at our institution, actually, Doug McLaughlin led the charge in our primary care pediatric outpatient offices, where he was doing challenges there. We helped onboard him and get him comfortable with, doing the risk assessment, and he's done a great job. They actually removed penicillin allergy from 30% of the patients who had it reported in a network of over 100,000 children, which is remarkable. But it needs to go widespread, and we need to, maintain the momentum in order to make this, have an impact on a population level. That's for sure.
I agree 100% with the population level, but I would also say it doesn't take that many people in this, in 2023 where healthcare is in such a pinch financially everywhere, it doesn't take that many people to save money on healthcare costs and antibiotic costs. So I truly think that yes, we have so much work to do on a population level, but every little bit counts.
Yeah.
And I do think this is a prime opportunity, like you say, to involve other healthcare professionals like pharmacists, like physician assistants, nurse practitioners, our colleagues from other specialties. Infectious disease in particular has been quite receptive to this because, for obvious reasons, they like to use the right man for the job, right man or woman for the job in terms of antibiotics. So I think there's many specialties that are amenable to learning about this and getting them right.
Yeah, and I don't want to steer too far off topic, but this makes me think of something else. And I recently read this, honestly, this very dire, scary article about how rates of antibiotic resistance have really skyrocketed. And can you offer some background about why that's so scary? And also, are there like a ton of new antibiotics in the pipeline from pharmaceutical companies, or are we kind of stuck right now?
I mean, I know it's sort of like doom scrolling, right? But yeah, so I think we've learned, actually, I think a good example for why this happens is that, I mean, we've all learned about sort of natural selection, right? And we've seen it happen in the last few years with a virus. And a virus is different than bacteria, but we've seen how fast, right, COVID has changed and eluded or changed our initial targeted therapies. And the same thing happens with bacteria, just on generally, thank goodness, a slower time frame. So these bugs find ways to elude our antibiotics. And that's just the nature of the beast. And unfortunately, there's not a ton of money in antibiotic development, and there's not a ton of focus on antibiotic development in the pharmaceutical world right now. So we're kind of stuck in that we have this sort of evolving microbiota that can elude some of the best defenses we used to have. And so we really need to be careful and choose the appropriate antibiotic for infections and not use antibiotics that really aren't as well equipped to handle specific types of bacteria, because that can just add to the resistance problem. So using broader antibiotics can be worse for that problem, and penicillin allergy delabeling can help combat against this.
Yeah, it really can. I mean, penicillin is a great, great antibiotic. It's inexpensive. It works really well against especially some of the most common causes of bacterial infection in children. So if you have that patient in front of you that has a reported allergy, it is worthwhile to take a few minutes to clarify and risk stratify, and it is more than likely they're going to be able to receive that again. And yeah, I appreciate your thoughts on that. But yeah, that article really, I don't tend to, get drawn into the hype and all the doom scrolling and things like that. But when I think about antibiotic resistance, it really does scare the hell out of me.
No, I think I'm right with you. I think that is a tough problem, and it's also another reason I'm drawn to drug allergy, because I really think we have a role to play in combating it, and that's really an important role and one that we should take seriously.
Yeah. Well, all right, back to our topic at hand. You have teased the audience for long enough, Dr. Ramsey. You've mentioned PenFast several times. What is PenFast and how can we use it?
So this is a clinical decision tool that was developed by our wonderful Australian colleague, Jason Trubiano, and his group. And it helps people risk stratify. So anytime you have a clinical decision rule, it kind of takes like the brain work out of it, which is great, right? That helps you generalize what you're trying to do. So it's called PENFAST. You can Google it and different diagrams will come up, all saying the same thing. And PEN stands for History of Penicillin Allergy. And then FAST is an acronym. And so the F stands for 5 or less years. The A stands for angioedema or anaphylaxis. S stands for severe cutaneous adverse reaction. And T stands for need for medical treatment. And each letter has a point value. And if a patient's score based on their historical reaction is less than 3, so 2 or 1 or 0, then they are considered low risk to have a reaction for or a reaction to a penicillin challenge. So a score of 2 or less, or I guess in the papers they say less than 3, I guess that's just semantics, qualifies you as a low risk challenge candidate for a penicillin challenge.
Yeah, it's so easy to use. I've played around with it. It's straightforward. It's very intuitive. They give you very clear, concise information regarding that specific patient that's in front of you. And I encourage everybody to check it out. As you said, you can just search for it on the internet and it pops right up. So that's great.
Yep. It's I don't know if I'm allowed to say it. It's on MedCalc. It's on, you can find it and just enter in the values and get your score.
Yeah, it's been validated and everything. So, okay. Well, so what about the argument of, all right, do we need to do this with every patient in the office? They come to see me for rhinitis and they say they have penicillin allergy. Why don't I just wait until they actually need the drug and then we can figure it out then?
I mean, don't we all want to plan ahead? So I think we know the benefits for this are not in question. So I think the watch and wait approach is problematic because then you're leaving it to chance. And we just alluded to how we have a lot of work to do to generalize this delabeling process. And on the treatment or urgent side of things, like at an urgent care or in an emergency room or in a hospital, the chances that someone is going to evaluate you for this at the point of care are pretty low, just given the state of how things are in 2023. So I think it's always better to take care of something when you are healthy, should you need it in the future, because you never know what other issues are going to come on at the time of illness that may prevent this from being a possibility. In our healthcare system, as I said before, we do complete these challenges on the inpatient side. But then there's also data in like special populations, like, for example, the hematology oncology population, where a lot of people don't want to do this when they're, hospitalized for something else. So I think taking care of it when there's no other issues at hand is just easier. It doesn't cloud the picture. And we know it's going to reap benefits in the future. Likely on an individual level, but certainly at a population level.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. Well, along those lines, what advice do you have for our colleagues who either don't believe in this at all as an important part of their evaluation, or they're just too stressed for time to add this on in their daily practice?
Yeah, I hope I've made the case that it is important. For all the individual reasons I mentioned, and then the public health reasons I mentioned, and if someone still needs convincing, as I said, I think that or as you pointed out, the penicillin center on the Quad AI website really helps drive that home. So any skeptics, I would invite to look there and read some of the more recent papers that really illustrate how important this is. In terms of office flow, I do really think this can be a great referral source, right? This is a nice way to keep yourself relevant if, some of your old bread and butter patients, maybe aren't coming as much in sort of a, allergic rhinitis or asthma just because of the healthcare pinch, I think this is another way to market yourself to colleagues in other fields to help them help their patients. And the drug allergy history is although nuanced and we want to be thorough, it actually doesn't take that long to take a good drug allergy history. So these are not patients that you're spending 45 minutes counseling before you do anything. It's actually a pretty straightforward history once you have it down, especially if you're using, like, if it, in the case of penicillin allergy, using a validated clinical decision tool, right? I mean, that doesn't get easier than that. And then we're allergists. We're used to having people hang out in our office after shots. So it's lower risk than that, right? So we've already figured out the office flow for allergy immunotherapy. This is easier than that, in my opinion, because you're just not going to have as frequent of reactions. So again, I think it's a pleaser all around. It can be a referral source. Patients are happy and referring providers are happy. So I'm not sure why you wouldn't do it. I can understand in the past with like skin testing and then it's a little more labor intensive, but administering a graded challenge to low risk patients, I mean, that is not, a staff labor intensive job at all.
Yes, well stated. I couldn't agree more. What about those in the general public who may be listening? What advice do you have for them if they've been told that they're allergic to penicillin?
I would advise them to bring it up with their primary care physician. If they're plugged in with an allergist, for sure, bring it up with their allergist. And it is an easy one-stop appointment. Depending on flow, I do think some offices take the drug allergy history at an initial appointment and then maybe have patients come back for a second visit. I would encourage people in our field to consider stocking amoxicillin in their office. So it's a one-stop for patients. Dave, you and your group published on that, mm-hmm. just sort of the effect of stocking amoxicillin in the office. That is huge for patients, right? Taking, one half day off of work or one, half day off of school versus two visits. So I think that also really helps streamline things for patients.
Oh, it was a huge, massive change in the way we approach this because people don't come back. We're busy. Lives are busy.
There's attrition.
Yeah. Just having amoxicillin there to use. It's super easy to do. And it makes a
cheap.
Huge difference. Yes, exactly. Extremely yep. inexpensive. Yeah. Well, thank you for plugging that.
Sure.
I have two other questions for you, then we can kind of wrap things up. All right. Let's imagine that you had, say, a blimp that could float around, or multiple blimps over a major city, every major city in America. What would be the message that you put on that blimp regarding penicillin allergy that you would want everybody to see?
It would be for patients and it would say, get your penicillin allergy evaluated if you have not already.
Wow.
Because I do think that patients are in some ways more proactive about this when they hear about it. And the word of mouth shouldn't be underestimated. So in this case, it would be the word from the blimp, but if that got people's attention to go in and get evaluated, I think that'd be great. And then patients asking their primary care physicians about it, I think also raises awareness among non-allergy immunology healthcare providers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, we're going to be releasing this in sometime in late September 2023, which is close to National Penicillin Allergy Day, which occurs on September 28th every year, which is the anniversary of when Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin. Why is it important to have an awareness day each year for this, and how do you personally plan to participate?
Well, I hope that you and I have done a good job convincing patients, people, listeners about why this is important. To mark it personally, I'm in clinic that day. It's not going to be that different than any other day, but I'm going to ask all my penicillin allergic patients that have that on their allergy field, I'm going to address it with each and every one of them, which is how I try to practice every day. I mean, I don't pretend to do it with 100% of people because sometimes they have more pressing issues. But on a personal level, I will be doing that. from an academy standpoint, there is a social media campaign that you have been working on with other colleagues to raise awareness regarding penicillin allergy in the ether, in the social medias. And then a number of us have written a letter to the editor that we are hoping to have published in a major newspaper covering some of the things, actually all the things we've talked about today. And then at night, after I've done all that, you know, I've looked and promoted the social media stuff that's going on, hopefully read the letter in the newspaper and delabeled my penicillin allergic patients, I'm obviously going to have a cupcake and a glass of wine in honor of Dr. Alexander Fleming.
Nice. Maybe some moldy bread perhaps as well.
Yeah, moldy bread, even better.
Yeah,
totally.
Maybe just put it next to you just to kind of look at it and give a little cheers. Yes. And so thank you for mentioning. So we have updated infographics. There's been infographics that anybody can use on the penicillin allergy website on through the academy, but you can go on there and actually use these infographics and you can post them. They're available for anybody to post to your social media channels, especially on September 28th. We want to flood the, it used to be Twitterverse, the Xverse, Instagramverse, Facebookverse, Metaverse, whatever it is, flood it with the same messages. Let people know if you think you have an allergy to penicillin, please get evaluated. So thanks for mentioning that. Well, Dr. Ramsey,
and Dave,
this is,
I had one more question. I thought you were privately funding a blimp to fly over Columbus for penicillin allergy day.
I own it. It's my blimp. I'll repurpose it for that. Yeah, I have the Fleming costume. I typically wear that anyways, and I'll fly the blimp while wearing it, and it'll be great. It'll be fantastic. You might be able to see it from Rochester. I don't know. It's a big blimp.
I'll look, and please post that on social media as well. Thank you.
Dr. Ramsey, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure we're going to have you back at some point to talk about other great stuff. It was a great, insightful conversation. Before we depart, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I really appreciate the opportunity. It was a pleasure speaking with you as well. I love podcasts, so thank you for having me on.
No, it's been our pleasure. Thank you. We hope you enjoyed listening to today's episode. Please visit www.aaai.org for show notes and any pertinent links from today's conversation. If you like the show, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify so you can receive new episodes in the future. Thank you again for listening.